Hi, David Barrett, founder of Trophy Buck Secrets, here with you for another Food Plot Success Summit expert interview. Get ready to learn some tremendous food plot tips during this call. Now, I'll turn things over to our host, Ralph Schroeder.
Thanks, Dave. Welcome to another installment of the Trophy Buck Secrets teleseminar series. Our special guest today is Dr. Judy McFarlane of DIY Deer Food Plots. Dr. McFarlane is the author of the book, Deer Food Plots Made Easy. Thanks for joining us today, Judy.
You're welcome.
And Judy, can you please tell our listeners at TrophyBuckSecrets.com a little bit about yourself?
I'm a veterinarian by trade, and my husband and I have a cattle ranch in Alberta, Canada. And so I spend half my time consulting in veterinary medicine and the other half of my time ranching. And we have about 100 head of cattle, and we have quite about 2,000 acres of agricultural crops, and we have a very large deer population, both whitetail and mule deer, in our area in Alberta.
Oh, okay. And what got you involved in food plotting and managing deer?
I think it's the reason that my husband and I both got involved was we had some areas which we thought would be amenable on our property to food plots, and we have several hunters that come to our ranch every year to hunt, and we also have two outfitters that use our land for both duck hunting and deer hunting. And so we started experimenting with food plots, mainly as a hobby, I would have to say.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the first thing I'd like to talk about involves the planning process. How much planning or forethought goes into the process of creating a food plot? Do you chart out the exact shape of the plot?
Mostly what I did and what I recommend you do is it's not real important what the shape of it is. So much as the location of it. And so if your goal, for instance, is to use it as a hunting attractant, then really a more secluded, smaller, slightly irregular plot, anywhere that you can get in with your ATV and do some work is a good location. And just keep in mind where you're going to put your stand or where you're going to put your blinds in relation to what the wind patterns are in that area. So foremost, we went out looking for what's a good secluded spot where deer will pass by or pass through, and what are the trends in the wind patterns or the predominant wind factors allowing us to properly place blinds in or around the area. So mostly it was, is it a good place to put a food plot? And secondly, then the question was how many of them, how big? And, the shape really was irrelevant in the smaller plots, 1 to 3 acre plots. They were usually just surrounded by trees or bedding areas or so forth. So the larger plots, though, I think the more rectangular they are, the easier they are to use equipment in. And but I think the average person starting out food plotting, it probably doesn't have access to a bunch of high-end agricultural equipment, and probably is not going to start out planting greater than 5 or 10 acres of food plots. If they do, though, I think the rectangular shape is superior. But for hunting plots, it's pretty much any place that you can find a spot that makes sense.
Okay, what's that? What would you recommend as far as like an average size for a hunting food plot?
I think really 1.5 to 3 acres is probably good enough. Certainly, if your goal is to hunt in and around them, the more of those small plots you have, the better, depending on your deer population. Certainly, if you have a 2-acre plot and there's really not a good native food source in the fall, the thing will get demolished before it ever comes up. So it really is in reference to how intense is the browse pressure. And certainly if the browse pressure is high, I think you have to go towards larger plots or multiple plots. If the browse pressure is low, then you can go with these smaller 1.5, 2-acre plots. Anytime you get bigger than 2 acres, though, I think if you're using an ATV to work and till the ground, you'll just burn out your bike very easily pulling equipment around. So I think really 1.5 to 2 acres is probably good for people using ATVs.
Okay, and you'd mentioned about, you know, planting them rectangular shaped. How narrow is, you know, considered good?
Actually, if you're in a larger, greater than 5 acre plot, you're probably using agricultural equipment, so you need room to turn around your tractor and so forth. But if you're using an ATV, literally the width of a bedroom is fine. A lot of times we'll use old logging trails or migratory trails to place food plots, and sometimes we do strips that are only as wide as 2 ATV passes.
Okay. And, you know, while doing this teleseminar series, we've talked to a couple of guests who have really delved into the topic of, you know, soil testing, as far as, like, the nuts and bolts of collecting samples and sending them off to a lab. However, one thing we haven't talked about in regards to soil testing is the cheap over-the-counter testing kits. What is your opinion of those kits? Are they accurate?
Yeah, I think they are accurate as far as pH goes. And certainly a pH is a huge factor in the ability of the plants to absorb nutrients. And so I think that they're good tests. They're cheap. They're accurate as far as pH goes. But pH is certainly not the only limiting factor. In some areas, it might be the most limiting factor, so I wouldn't discourage necessarily someone from using a pH kit if that's all they can manage to get done or that's the only thing they have access to. But most places in agricultural, you know, the USDA and the agricultural affiliations have places where you can get sheep soil tests done, and they actually analyze organic matter and shorten nutrients such as magnesium and phosphorus and stuff and potassium. These might be limiting factors even if your pH is good. So pH is one of the big things. I think everybody knows about pH, but there are some plants where pH is the number one factor, but secondary is, for instance, the need for magnesium or potassium or phosphorus. And so consequently, I think that the better really dollar value is in getting the full test done, plus most of those services offer consultation with the soil test on what amendments you need to do to your soil to make it ideal for that specific set of plants that you decided to go ahead with.
And can you give an example of a client that skipped the soil test and had a poor result?
Yes, I had a client contact me through the website, and he had actually tried to put a clover stand in for 3 consecutive years and had really a moderate success at best and was very unhappy. And, of course, the number one thing people do is blame the seed or blame the company that they bought the seed from. And on talking to him and investigating, I realized that he had not done a soil test. And once he did, in fact, do his soil test, he needed to put in 3 tons of lime in a small plot in order to get the pH even into the zone where it would provide the plants with, you know, an adequate base in order to produce well. And so most plants have a fairly wide range of pH tolerance, most like neutral, which is 7. But some of them will grow from 5.5 to, say, 7.5 as a pH, but they grow best at neutral. So you'll often see in the literature or on the plant websites that, you know, it tolerates acidity. Well, it may tolerate it, but that's not the same as producing well. So this person had to put in 3 tons of lime in a small plot. That's a lot of lime in order to make it suitable. And so sometimes what happens is, people will do a soil test, and they'll go, there's way too much lime needs to be added here, or way too much fertilizer necessary to grow what I want to grow, so I'm going to go pick a different site and try another soil test. I've actually discounted a couple of places on our ranch that would have been really ideal locations based on the soil test alone. I went, I don't want to put in the time, money, and effort in order to get the soil ready to go.
Right. Some places just aren't worth it, I guess.
You know, and it's all depends on the person. Some people have, you know, unlimited financial resources. That's not the case for most of us. And some people have limited amount of time, you know, so they have this opportunity of a few times during the year to get out to a place where they're going to do a plot. They certainly don't want to be spending a lot of extra time and money getting it ready to go, and they, especially if they have the option of having a different location. This person had only one location that was really decent for a plot, and so consequently decided it was worth the money to put the lime in there. But had, I mean, 3 years of wasted time and effort over a soil test, and lime is not all that expensive. So in terms of the rest of the nutrients of the soil, they were fine. It's just the pH was really poor for a clover stand.
Mm-hmm. And after you've, you know, done all that soil testing at the site, what is the first step in the process of getting it ready to plant?
I think what I'll normally do is in the first year for beginners, I will usually start around mid-May, and I usually let the weeds or the native growth come up about 3 or 4 inches, and then I usually spray the area completely with Roundup. And the idea there is to pretty much kill the native browse that's there or the native grasses that are there. And some, usually by mid-May in most locations, the growth is not higher than 3 to 4 inches, but if it is, then you need to get in there with a, you know, a bush hogger, a weed whacker, or anything just to cut down the height of it so that there's good contact with the Roundup, so you get a proper, you know, chemical burn the first time around. So that's the first thing I do, and usually I go get my soil test, and then I do this first Roundup of killing the weeds, if you will, and as my first step in mid-May.
And how important is it to kill those native grasses? Will they actually choke out the seeds that you're broadcasting?
Absolutely. You know, in having read most of the plot books myself and being on the internet all the time, I think that the most underutilized resource that plotters have is good weed control. And I think that there's a lot of emphasis on getting the right seed, the right product, and there's not a lot of emphasis placed on proper preparation, if you will, of the seed bed, which is all about the weed control. And I think that the weeds will choke them out. That's one thing they do. The other thing is they just suck up valuable nutrients. So even though they may not choke the stand out, they can decrease its productivity so it can't grow fast enough to, say, keep up with grazing and browsing.
Okay, and then after all that, you know, what do you do next, and most importantly, when?
Yeah, usually I usually give it 2 to 3 weeks, so either in, you know, late May or early June, there's going to be a bunch of dead thatch there. You need to remove that, and I've got out there in some small plots and physically removed it with rakes. If you are in an area where you can use controlled burning or there's somebody who can do that for you, certainly that's going to be superior to manually just removing thatch, but either way works. And that's also a good time in late May and early June to apply the lime if you have to. Ideally, you want to apply lime a few months ahead of time, but sometimes as early as 6 weeks ahead of your planting can be adequate to have a positive effect. And so once I have that thatch removed in, you know, late May, early June to mid-June, then what I do is I will respray after there's 3 to 4 inches of new growth again. So I'm spraying 2 or 3 times in some plots before I even think about tilling and planting seeds. So we're doing a lot of, you know, a lot about weed control or native grass control before we ever start putting things in the ground.
Okay, and why is it so important to follow these steps closely before moving forward?
I think for me, you know, I'm all about the efficiency, right? So sometimes I've skipped those steps, you know, so I can tell you that the skipping the steps and being in a hurry just means that you lose later on, and you usually end up having to go back and redo, or you have an unsuccessful season in total because you just didn't follow the steps. And we'd all like to cut corners, and certainly Roundup isn't cheap, and your time isn't cheap, and so we're all looking for that shortcut. But I think in the end, you either end up with these unsuccessful plots or decreased production where the graze pressure is so high that it just kills the plot because the plot isn't given the best chance to start right off the bat. So I think that you will learn from your mistakes like I did if you, you know, try to skip steps. But I think it is worth the time and effort to not skip the appropriate steps.
Okay, and say, for instance, that you've planted a food plot and it's not taking off, you know, quite how you hoped it would. Is there any chance of replanting it that year, or is it pretty much a wash until next year?
No, I think that if you planted, say, in mid to late July, and you have a couple, 2 or 3 weeks, and something's not, you know, it's not coming up like it should be, or it's not germinating like it should be, you could, in fact, replant that same season. I don't think it's a wash, or you can plant, you know, over top or broadcast over top. Usually what happens, though, is when something isn't coming up like I had hoped it would, the number one question I say to myself is, all right, why is it not germinating? You know, did I put the seed too deep or too superficial? Is the soil not adequately prepared in terms of the pH and so forth? There must really, if you don't get a good coming up, then there's something usually wrong with your technique or how deep your seed went or how shallow it went or how much moisture is in the soil versus it comes up really great and then it gets hammered and killed by the deer. So those are kind of two separate problems. So if it's not coming up well, you may be better off if you skipped a step of the soil test, you might want to consider it then. If you did, in fact, do the soil test, then you could reconsider how you planted the seed and whether or not you prepared the seed bed correctly for that seed. For instance, some of these, if you don't till fine enough, some of these broadcasting seeds, they are so small and fine that they will go down into the little cracks and they'll get too deep to germinate properly. So sometimes it's just an error in seed bed preparation. Likewise, if you have the bigger seeds like oats, if you don't put them deep enough, they don't do well either. And so I think those are the number one and two failure things that people do when the plots just don't come up well. It either has to do with the soil itself or with the way that you spread the seed, and there may be problems with how deep or shallow the seeds went.
Okay, and, you know, speaking of, like, spreading the seeds, how dense do you plant, like, when you're broadcasting the seed? Do you spread it out pretty thin?
Yeah, there's a recommended broadcasting rate for every different seed mixture, and you need to follow those very precisely. You know, I've made the mistake myself with grass seed of just, you know, more is better. Well, I'm here to tell you more isn't better because what it does is it actually chokes itself out. There's just not enough nutrients to provide good germination and early rapid growth when you put too much seed down. So on my blog there, which is www.vetjudy.com, I have quite a bit of information there about food plotting and stuff that's short discussions, if you will, and there's one segment on there on accurately measuring your plot. And it's important to not go, I think it's an acre-ish, you know, because the broadcast, I know, and I've done it too, right? It's like you just eyeball it and you go, yeah, and then, you know, you got a little extra seed, so you throw it out there, and there's a whole discussion on the blog about why not to do that, but certainly it can choke itself out if you plant too thick. If you plant too thin, then you just don't, you get sparse growth, which allows weeds to grow. So either way, it's not ideal. What is ideal is actually physically calculating your acreage properly, and don't throw in two less, and don't throw in more just because you got some left. Just, you know, hold back from that urge because I've done it too, and it didn't work out.
Something that's always really confused me is that, you know, a lot of times I'll walk into a sporting goods store, flip through a catalog, and I'll see all these different types, you know, from brassicas to, you know, chicory, all these different types of seeds, and I don't know which to choose, you know. So can you provide any insight on, you know, choosing the right seed for your property?
Yeah, I think that's a tremendous stumbling block for most people, and I think that's actually one of the reasons they don't get started food plotting. It's because they look at the plant selection and they go, oh my gosh. And you start reading some of those plant profiles and you're like, I don't know, what's a northern annual and a summer fall perennial, blah, blah. You know, you just get confused. And so I think that the biggest thing you can do is, and a cheap and easy resource is to consult someone from that's related to the agriculture or planting industry in your area. Most people can give you advice about which one of these seeds the deer eat, in fact, will grow in your area. And I put together some charts I'm writing a second edition of my book now, and I put some charts and some maps for, you know, whether it's a warm season annual in one part of the states and a cool season annual in another part, and it's all very confusing. But I think certainly most people can find somebody in their local area that is serving the agricultural community in some way, and those people can help you. And you can pick a few different ones pretty much off of any deer food plotting website. You can pull four or five names of different plants that deer like to eat. There's probably the common ones. There's probably 15 or 20 of them, and you can go and talk to the local person about, will any of these grow here? The other option is you can use, some of the Quality Deer Management Institute, Whitetail Institute. These people have consultants online, and if you buy your seed from them, they will help you. But they will want to know where you're located. They'll want to know what the pH of your soil is, and before they give you any advice. And most of them deal in mixes, and the reason for that is because it takes the advantage of the best of all the plants, the best characteristics of all the plants are put together, and mixes are a good thing. They're not necessarily the cheapest way to go, but I think you can get good advice from those people and you can get good mixes. But it just doesn't matter how expensive the seed is and how good the advice is. If you don't do the proper soil testing and the proper soil treatment and the proper tillage, you can lose the whole thing at the end.
All right. So, another thing I've heard you talk about just now is that annuals and perennials. And I understand that, annuals come up every year and perennials are, a seasonal thing?
The annuals basically are annually planted. So there's summer annuals and fall annuals. And so basically what that means is you're either planting in the fall or the spring, and those are called the fall annuals, or you're planting in the summer. Or early spring. And so really, it's really about when you plant it, it's either fall, winter, spring, or summer. When you're planting, it lasts one season and then it's done. So the minute the snow flies, you're finished. And the perennials are combinations that will come up, anywhere, depending on the area you're located, which ones you're using, anywhere from 1 to 5 years you can get out of a perennial. And some people, I for instance, will sometimes use perennials annually because I get better crops that way. But I think that the big difference is just one, ideally, the perennial, they take longer to establish. And I think you should be a more experienced food plotter before you start going perennials because they are harder to establish and they need better weed control to get a good crop started or a good stand started. But they can be a little lower maintenance in the long haul. They're more expensive to put in the first year, but you may get more time out of it and less maintenance in the long haul. But for the beginner, I recommend annuals across the board. And what that means, and I like the fall annuals because then you can spend almost the whole entire first season dealing with the weeds and tillage issues, and then get a good stand and get a good success. And then you're happy to do that next year because I can tell you you're not as motivated in year number two if year number one didn't go well. So that's the basic difference between the annuals and perennials. And go ahead.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there. But so annuals are the best to plant if it's a food plot that you plan on hunting over?
I think you can, yes, I would have to say that the annuals would be my preference for a food plot that you're hunting around or near. And the reason is that most of the fall annuals are species that will reach their maximum production when the native forage is falling down. And so they will be looking for another food source, and your food source will be palatable and present when their native browse is deteriorating. So I think that's the reason that fall annuals are preferred species for deer during hunting season, because that's when the native browse is either gone or has deteriorated, you know, to a very unpalatable state. And so if you're offering something that is very, very tasty at a time when everything else doesn't taste so good, you certainly have a good drive for deer to get to your plot.
Okay, so it really enhances the attraction and how frequently deer will be using that plot.
Correct. And they're trying to prepare for winter, and the demands of the rut are, you know, very severe in some areas and combined with the preparation for winter. So I think that anything you can do helps them nutritionally, and the attraction factor is fairly big when nothing else is available that's interesting or palatable. The lignans, which is really the fibrous portion of all plants, increases at the end of its growth season, and that stuff isn't tasty. You'll eat it if you have to, but you'd prefer something that's got less fibrous plant material in it and is more succulent. So things like brassicas and so forth, they actually get more palatable. Rapeseed and brassicas, they get more palatable after one or two frosts, and so that's just a really good timing.
So those are some of your favorite fall annuals for northern regions?
Yeah, I like chicory and rapeseed, and I usually just put half of the plot, you know, into each of them. I don't mix them up. I just put them, I kind of do soil stands. And I usually just have, you know, chicory in the front and rapeseed in the back, and I just have a block of each. And I like those because they're very tasty. They're tasty at the right time, and they're fairly easy to grow, and they do well in northern regions as well.
Okay, how about for, say, southern regions of the United States where deer are found?
Yeah, you know, there's some, I think that the soybeans are pretty good, and some of the oats, forage oat crops do okay in some of the warmer regions. There is quite a big variability in the south about what will grow. For instance, the growth charts for various species, sometimes they will run only in the bottom half of a state or the northeast corner of a state and not in the southwest. And so I think it's difficult for me to make a blank recommendation for the south. I think that they get a lot more fussy depending on what the moisture levels are, how droughty it is, depending on the area, how high the heat is during the late fall still when you're trying to plant these, and especially summer annuals. And so that's where I think that if you're going to be in the south and a local plant expert and make sure that the species you want to use is going to survive the conditions at the time when you're going to plant it, I think that it's almost like the conditions further south are even more harsh because of the difficulty in getting plants to germinate is sometimes a huge issue, right? You're trying to put them in late summer or fall, if you're using fall annuals, and you know, the worst heat has already been present, right, for several months, and so this can be a serious problem. So I think it's difficult to recommend a specific plant species that does well across the south, and I have some lists on the site that addresses some of those issues, but I think your local plant agricultural resource is probably going to help you, or alternatively, the Quality Deer Management Association, Whitetail Institute, they have consultants there that will take your specific state and portion of your state and then give you the best recommendation for that area.
Okay, so after the seeds are planted, sort of maintenance do you do?
Usually I'll go in and depending, you know, ideally if you've prepared the soil right and you've done the weed control properly, you shouldn't really need to do a lot of maintenance, especially with the annuals. Mowing and stuff becomes more important with the perennials, and the reason that you mow the perennials a couple, two or three times a season, depending on how fast they're growing, the reason you mow them is to cut down on weed competition and to keep them in an actively growing state so that they stay palatable for the deer. And once they get past a certain height, they're not as palatable. And so mowing is more commonly done with perennials and annuals. But if I do have a weed problem, then I will actually go in and mow it, mow the grass between usually in the 4 to 6 inch range.
Oh, okay. Okay. Do you ever use any fertilizer at all at some point?
Yeah, you know, most of the time when we first started plotting, the land was not heavily taxed. You know, it was more secluded areas that we put the plots in. And to be honest with you, we didn't have to put a lot of fertilizer down in the early times. The more repetitively you use the plots, certainly then you will have to put fertilizer. How and what type of fertilizer with what percentages is totally dependent on your soil and the plant species you're planting. So there's no sort of general, just throw a 15, 15, 15 on that. You really need to know what the crop is really important and what your soil is at. It's really going to depend what fertilizer and how much you put. And the fertilizer thing is another one of those, don't just eyeball it and guess it. Because you can act, you know, when you fertilize anything, you fertilize the plant, but you also fertilize the weed. And if you're fertilizing the weed at the expense of the plant because of requirements, you can actually mess up your plot by inappropriate fertilizing or too much fertilizing. And you can also burn the crop with too much fertilizer. So, again, it's one of those, pay attention to how much land you have and spread it like you're supposed to be spreading it, and don't just, I mean, some people get lucky, right? You just eyeball it, yeah, you eyeball it, it comes out okay, but for the average person, eyeballing it and just throwing stuff out there is probably not the best approach, and if you have a failure, you're wondering what went wrong. I mean, the odd time you just have a good eye for it. If you've never done anything in agriculture before, I wouldn't recommend eyeballing it.
Okay.
Like my husband has a really, you know, he's been in agriculture his whole life, right? And so, you know, he's pretty good at eyeballing.
Yeah.
Because he's fertilized enough crops and burnt enough crops and had seed failures and germination, and he's done all those things on a much bigger scale. And so he, you know, has a fairly good eye for it. But I think the average person might have some hunting property. They might be putting a small plot on some government land somewhere. They might, you know, they live in a natural wooded area and they want to just put some small plots out there, and they don't have a lot of agricultural background. So in those cases, I think it's important to, quote, unquote, follow the recipe.
Okay. So, you know, let's say you've got all your planting done and the plants are starting to poke up through the soil. Do you need to keep deer out of certain forages until they ripe or to give the plants a chance to grow?
I think if you are in an area with high, like if you have a high, like a lot of deer and their native forage is poor, for instance, if you look in a wooded area and you see that there is a really empty dead space to about 3 feet up the tree, if you put a plot in there, I guarantee you it's not even going to come up. You're going to wonder where it went. They'll be nibbling it off before it ever gets out of the ground, so to speak.
Right.
I think those either need to be fenced, if that's the level of pressure that you have with the deer population. A good example would be where I consult in Jersey. You know, I'm driving around New Jersey, and there are lots of areas, it's so heavy here, that you can see from your on the trees to the level of your head. You can see all the way through the bush. It's like if I put a plot in there, I guarantee if you don't fence that, that's never going to get up. So if you, so you either need to fence it, or have noisemakers, or hang grocery bags, I mean, anything to keep them out of there long enough for it to germinate and get up to be 3 or 4 or 5 inches high. But if you don't have a lot of pressure, then you don't need to do any of that. You don't need to keep them out, because they'll come in and they'll nibble, but they're not going to trash the place.
Okay. Watch the party animals. Is it a good idea to fence in a little control area to see how much the deer are mowing down your crops?
I think it is a good idea, especially when you're starting. And the reason is that when you're having a failure, you need to be able to go back and analyze what maybe went wrong. And so if you have a little teeny area that's fenced in, like a bit of chicken wire or something, then you can say, well, gee, that stuff is 6 inches high, but everything else is completely mowed down. Well, what that says to me is that the browse pressure is very high. And, the deer are just walking right by and they happen to stop in, but there's a lot of them. And so that would tell me that you need to either fence off the area or provide some sort of a deer deterrent, if you will, until it has the ability to get going. If, however, the thing that you've isolated isn't growing any better than the rest of what's in that stand, then it's not due to browse pressure that's causing the failure.
Okay. So what's the most important tip you can give somebody starting a new plot?
I would have to say that the first and foremost is to pick the location carefully. And if you have the option of where to put it, to pick, do several spots, several locations that you like. Do the soil test in each of them. Pick the one that is most likely to succeed just based on the natural soil characteristics, because that can save you a lot of time and money. If you, I think that's probably the number one thing, is to pick the location that is good for the use that you want to use it for. If you want to hunt from it, it needs to be selected based on the ability to use the surrounding area, as camouflage and the winds and so forth. If you're primarily using it for viewing, for photography, the same rules apply. If you're using it for feed plots, then it really amounts to areas where you can get your tractor in and out and so forth. But the number one thing, I think, is to pick a good location and pick several if you have the option. Do soil tests on all the locations and just start with the one that has the nicest soil.
Yeah, okay. Well, Judy, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
It has been a pleasure talking to you.
For our listeners who'd like to learn more about DIY deer food plots and your book, Food Plots Made Easy, can you give us your website address?
Yeah, it's www.diydeerfoodplots.com.
Okay, and we've been talking to Dr. Judy McFarland of DIY Deer Food Plots. Thank you to all of you folks who have been listening to this installment of the Trophy Buck Secrets Teleseminar Series. I'm Ralph Scherger, and once again, here's Dave Barrett, founder of Trophy Buck Secrets.
Thanks, Ralph. Well, we've made it easy for you to check out Dr. Judy's book. Just click the button on the left that says DIY Deer Food Plots, and you'll be taken to her website. Now, once you're there, click the big red button that says Free Download. Just enter your name and email on the next page and click Submit to get your free training series. You'll be glad you did. So, thanks again for joining us for this installment of the Food Plot Success Summit. Now, go ahead and click that link, and we'll see you on the next call.